I was just corrected that it's definitely not Pascal, it's Pascal. And I got called out on the last episode for mispronouncing that. And we had homemade apricot, is that apricot?
Apricot ice cream, yes.
Apricot ice cream. Ooh. And it was divine.
I was in Rwanda for 6 weeks and I wrote this. What happened was the company that we had connections to, they ran all the ATMs in the country. And I started doing it in Java and it was just so awful. And then my boss at the time suggested that I do it in Ruby. And that was a fantastic decision because Ruby's great for string handling.
Welcome to ADSP, the podcast, episode 152, recorded on October 18th, 2023. My name is Connor, and today with my co-host Bryce, we interview Jonathan O'Connor and chat with him about his journey from C++ to Java to Ruby and back to C++, as well as his programming experience with Ruby in Rwanda, Quines, and more. Let us introduce our guest first. Let me hop over. Because I actually went and found Mr. Jonathan O'Connor's bio from Meeting C++, which is a conference I know that you've given a couple different talks at, I believe.
This one is
entitled Hands-On C++ 20, Ranges, Coroutines, Concepts, and Modules. And the bio...
No, that's not me.
No? Oh, no, wait. Correction. That is a very poorly placed advertisement. Right on top of your profile picture and your name, and then in very small, I guess it's the same font as the font size as the bio. It says talks : Alice's Adventures in Template Land, but I guess this is an advertisement for a book, which I mean I'm pretty sure it's very unintentional on Jens's part, the organizer of the conference and the designer of the website. I got to take a screenshot of this. So we can put this in the show notes just so that people don't come at me for thinking like it has no border. So like on Compiler Explorer, they have ads at the top in the banner, but they're always in like a little green kind of highlighted thing. It's very clear that this is an ad. This is just like a hyperlinked image. And if you look closely in the bottom left-hand corner, it says capital AD in what looks like size 7 font. Anyways, whether that stays in or not, I mean, personally, I know Jonathan because we met. I mean, I believe you were at the conference too. This was 2019, Meeting C++.
The three of us had dinner at a Vietnamese restaurant.
About 10 minutes
walk.
That's right.
And I think both of you at the time were not drinking any alcohol, which seems to have changed during your road trip.
I mean, for 50% of us, Bryce is still...
For 50% of us.
Yeah, Bryce is still on that, the golden path to success.
Fair enough.
Is that the first time that we met, Jonathan?
I think it's probably the only time we've met in person. I don't think we've met since, no.
However, I met Jonathan for I believe it was the second time because I have a sister that currently lives in Dublin, Ireland, and you live just outside of Dublin. And my sister and I went and visited you at your lovely home and you hosted us. You had some family there. And the highlight, of course, enjoying Jonathan's lovely company was amazing, but the highlight was something I actually think I said I was going to tweet about it, and then I didn't tweet about it. It was, and if I recall the flavor, it was apricot. Am I correct in that?
It was, yes, apricot, as we say in Ireland. Ice cream.
I've discovered that I've been pronouncing all these words. I was just corrected that it's definitely not Pascal, it's Pascal. And I got called out on the last episode for mispronouncing that. And we had homemade... Apricot? Is that apricot?
Apricot ice cream, yes.
Apricot ice cream.
Ooh.
And it was divine. And that was, I think, the second time we met. But yes, back to this bio. It reads, in 1998, I joined, I'm going to mess this one up, Glockenspiel?
No, that was 1988. Maybe I wrote that wrong or something. But
No. I just have, what do you call it? Not dyslexia. There's a word for it with numbers called, what is it called? Dyscalculia.
Dyscalculia. Ah, okay.
Who knows? I just misread it.
Okay. But Glockenspiel, yeah, I joined Glockenspiel in 1988. I had two friends of mine were working there, and they recommended me to their boss, and I had a 40-minute conversation with them and was hired. That was how people used to get hired in the old good old
40
days.
40 minutes.
40 minutes. Ooh. Yeah.
How many leak code questions in that 40 minutes? You know, how many linked lists did you have to reverse?
I don't think any, actually. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah,
you worked there.
I worked there for a few years, and I wrote. That's where I learned C++. And two of my fellow colleagues there, they worked on the compiler on the CFront, which was, the predecessor to an actual proper compiler. It would generate C code, which you'd then get a C compiler to compile to assembler or machine code. There was Martin O'Riordan, who was the only member of the Irish from Ireland who was on the standards committee for many, many years. And he helped to write the first, Microsoft's first C++ compiler back in like 1990, 1991. And John Caves, who I suspect Bryce has met John Caves. He's still on the standards committee. And he's still working for Microsoft. And the two of them were in Glockenspiel at the time.
What a what a time and what a group of folks to get to work with.
It was a lot of fun. I worked on a GUI framework for it. We wrote a library where you could create Windows programs and also OS2 programs, which is another operating system that has come and gone. I then got involved a lot in education. So I would go off and train a company for a week in how to write good C++, as it was in the day. The language was so small, and we had no standard library. We had no string class. There was a coroutines library that shipped with CFront, which was in, I think, the first edition of Struthstrup. There's a chapter at the very back of the book that describes how to use it. And that, of course, disappeared in the second edition and later editions. And finally, we've got back some kind of what we've got. I'm not sure if the coroutines that we have now are the same or quite different from the ones that were back in this library. It's a long time ago.
And famously, or not famously, but according to the bio, you left the world of C++ for for Java and then Ruby. Although Ruby, I love Ruby.
Ruby's
great.
Lovely
Ruby
language.
Is what do you call it? A not derivative language, a child language, if you will, of Smalltalk, which I think most Ruby people know, but maybe there's some that don't. But was his name Mats? Was a huge fan of Smalltalk, and there's a bunch of stuff in Ruby that is basically completely borrowed from the Smalltalk model. So you did that for how many years? 10 to 15? Or
no, I did it for about 6 or 7.
Was just Ruby, or
it was just it was Ruby. It was the first project I got to write in Ruby was I wrote a little translator for ATM messages. And I did that in Rwanda, which was great fun.
I want to understand here. You did that for the Rwanda market, or you did that while you went to Rwanda?
I was in Rwanda for 6 weeks, and I wrote this. What happened was the company that we had connections to, they ran all the ATMs in the country, and that happened to be, I think, at the time in 2010. They had 14 ATMs in a country of 10 million people.
There were 14. 14?
14. 1-4, yes.
Wow.
And
so that's about one per what, 800,000 or something like that?
Something like that. Yes, exactly. And the company had bought another 10 ATMs, but those ATMs were not quite compatible with their server software. And if they wanted to get, if they wanted to update their server, they could get a module for their server software, but that module would cost like 50 grand. And they thought, nah, they'll get somebody like me to do it for a few weeks, and I'll just write a little translation program that sits in the middle on a little netbook, and it listens for messages from the ATM and it listens for messages from the server, and it just translates. Most of the messages are the same, so it just goes all the way through. It's passed through, but there's a few messages that have to be tweaked. And I started doing it in Java, and it was just so awful. And then my boss at the time suggested that I do it in Ruby, and that was a fantastic decision because Ruby's great for string handling and slicing and all that kind of stuff. So it was just so much easier than Java.
This is very true for leak coding purposes. Sometimes Ruby is the best language for speed / length, because it has a ton of convenience methods on strings like to_i and like to_b, I believe. And that one is super useful because it's like to base, and then you provide the base. If you have like a string number, it will actually, maybe that's on integers, I can't remember. The point is that there's a bunch of these like tiny 4-character convenience methods where if you need to convert like an integer to its base 2 representation, which is going to be like, you know, a 10-line program in C++, if you're going through it, you can just do that in like literally 10 characters in Ruby. And a ton of super nice convenience. Sometimes they have odd names, but once you figure out what it's called, they are very, very nice to have.
Yeah, I think for me, the nicest thing there was that you have slices in Ruby. And so you can slice an array or slice a string, and you can give it like a little sub-range with, I think it was dot, dot. So you can say like zero, you can take a string, square bracket, 0.3, and that'll give you, close square bracket, and that'll give you the first 4 characters of the string. And the nice thing about that is that, nice thing about Ruby is that if the string is only like two characters long, it doesn't matter. It'll give you those two, and it'll say, oh, I know you wanted 4, but, you know, 2 is all you can get, and I'm not going to complain about it. Whereas in Java, it's you want 4 characters, it's only got 2. Oh, sorry, I'm throwing an exception here. So from that point of view, things were very nice. It was much simpler to do this in Ruby.
But doesn't Python have?
Yeah, Python has slicing. That now too. I'm not sure if they have the short circuiting only give you what it has. But I'm not sure. Maybe at the time, Python didn't. This is what, 2000s?
I have to admit, I know very little Python. I can just about read it, but
yeah. The key thing is, though, is Java definitely did not. And like Java, no. I know modern Java has introduced like 20 or 21 introduced some new string facilities and types that makes it way, way easier. But like back in the day, they had like, you know, strings were immutable, and then they had string buffers and string builders. And it was just like coming from a language where you can, you know, manipulate strings easily. Java, it was you were jumping through hoops to do like very simple things, which is, you know, a large inconvenience if you're not used to having to do that. Even in C++, like dealing with strings is pretty, you can, you know, add 2 strings together. It's not too bad. Like, sure, you have to make sure you don't trip up on string literals and constructors and stuff. But I remember like Java was, I was like, what? I got to go learn about a builder now? Like, I just want to do something real simple. They're like, well, if you want to do something that involves mutability, then you're going to need a builder. And I was like, really?
Yeah, I think that went away by Java 5 or Java 6. But anyway, nevertheless.
I have some questions about this Rwanda ATM situation. So are all the ATMs in Rwanda still run by this netbook that's running your Ruby code?
I think no. I think we had a net. I think that we were going to have a netbook per ATM.
Okay. Okay. So is each ATM in Rwanda still running this Ruby code that you wrote?
I have no idea, but I suspect the answer is definitely no. I mean, at the time, we had the best internet connection in Rwanda, and it was 360k baud. So
that's not a lot for our younger
it's
listeners.
It's not a lot. And I know now that they have excellent internet in the country. From talking to friends of mine who live there, so they're things are fine now, but at the time it was pretty poor. And also the other good thing about using a netbook was that it was like it had good battery life, so you could survive power outages and the system would continue to work, which was also pretty important. And the last point about the netbook was that, like, these were, they cost, what, $200? They cost nothing. But we were only getting maybe, when somebody was using the ATM, you might get a message every second. You might get, like, 10 messages, and that was it. So you didn't have to be high-powered at all. And Ruby was there for totally fine. There was no speed constraints on the system.
So what year was this?
This was 2010.
Yeah, so it's pretty consistent. I just looked it up, and I don't know how accurate this data is, but the Federal Reserve Economic Data website, something like that. And it says that in 2010, there was only 84, but just like 3 years earlier, it was 16. So, I mean, that's definitely consistent with what you're saying. And it peaked, according to this site, in 2017, they had 406 countrywide. I was assuming that number was going to be like in the thousands. And it's actually gone down. So currently, as of 2022, this website says that there are 347 ATMs in Rwanda. Wow. And that is very, I mean, surprising. But then I guess I've heard that a lot of African countries use, like, I don't know what the name of the app is, but like the equivalent in China is Weixin or
They have an app. It was the first. I think it was the first app in the world. It was done by a Kenyan company, and they called it M-Pesa. M-Pesa is Swahili for money, I believe.
And then a lot of banking happens on like cell phones. Like,
yeah,
they
exactly.
They skipped a whole. I don't know, like evolution step that, you know, Western countries went through because everyone had cell phones before they had.
And in fact, M-Pesa it wasn't even on a smartphone. It was on the old like Nokia. And they would install this tiny app onto the phone, and you would then type in the phone number of the person you want to send. You'd type in an amount of money and you'd click send and there'd be maybe one other thing, and that would send your money.
The netbook thing, you know, I think a lot of people's first reaction is, oh, you're like, that's so like hacky, like, yo, you should go put it on a Raspberry Pi, put it on some, you know, little embedded server.
No Raspberry Pis back then.
But the battery thing is so clever. Like, one, they're super cheap, and two, like, you know, your little Raspberry Pi or your edge computing device doesn't have a you know, a battery backup system built into it, but a laptop does.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cheap and it worked.
I love that. I love that story.
But the reason why there were only like 14 or ATMs in the country at the time was about maybe 3 years before. The president of the country, Paul Kagame, he'd been somewhere traveling in maybe America or somewhere like that, and the hotel had asked to take a scan of his credit card, and he didn't have a credit card, and he felt somewhat embarrassed about this. So when he came back home, he said, "Right, we're going to mandate. We're going to have credit cards for people or electronic cards," and that's why. This company was started.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is a what do you call it, a fortunate or unfortunate series of events that, like, you know, leads to... and so it, before that point, I guess they didn't have... I guess, what does this graph say? It says, yeah, in 2004, there was only two.
Oh, okay. So they actually had some then, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if it's two, I mean, odds are they're, you know, that you're going to find yourself standing next to one when you need one is... pretty astronomically low, this probability of that.
Yeah.
All right, but you found your way back to C++ and what did the BIOS?
Yeah,
say,
that would be about 2016. I started reading stuff about it again and found that the language had totally changed from what I remembered. Mm-hmm. From, like, I last wrote C++ about 2001, and then I switched to Java at that stage, and then 10 years later I switched to Ruby. But 2016 came back, there was move semantics. Wow, that was like, that took me forever to figure out.
What was your favorite? So you were, you know, your mind was you know, befuddled by move semantics, but from 2001 to 2016, that's I guess 11 and 14, what was like the biggest, or I guess, how do you phrase the question? What was your favorite change, and like, what was the biggest paradigm shift from when you were coding? Or,
well, you had a standard library for a start.
That's not what I was expecting you to say. But no, I guess that is a big deal.
Things we take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, we had strings. We had
not very good ones, but they're still strings.
Yeah. Exactly.
Vector's okay.
Yeah, vector. You had all these, you know, useful, you know, you have maps, hash maps, and whatever. It's fantastic, and that's something that the old languages never had. You know, Pascal, I don't think had. No, it didn't have any standard. It had standard output. You could print stuff to files and to the console, but that was it.
Interesting. So Java, I mean, because Java famously has a massive standard library. Was that the first language of the languages back in the 90s that kind of started to ship with code that you could use and not have to write yourself?
I would think so.
Smalltalk had
a big library, absolutely.
Yeah, and I guess Java is also a descendant of Smalltalk. You know, even though
it's not really.
People hear object oriented and they think of both of those languages, but yeah, I guess you could argue that, you know, there's some other language that Java.
I'm wondering. I'm trying to remember Lisp, which was my favorite language in college. That had a lot of stuff in it. You could do a lot of, but I'm not sure if I don't think. Well, with Lisp, like, you've got the core, and then everything else is kind of added on. And
I feel like I've heard that Common Lisp famously also had massive amounts that like shipped with it, and that was kind of both a pro and a con, because Lisp is famous for being this very small, nuclear, homoiconic, you know, data is code kind of thing. But then Common Lisp went this other direction, and this is all just third party from having heard people give talks on this, is like it shipped with a ton of stuff that kind of like ruined that. Like, it still had the core somewhere inside it, but it shipped with a bunch of stuff. But I've honestly never programmed in Common Lisp.
I haven't either. I used a Lisp called Franz Lisp, which had lots of puns.
Franz Lisp.
Franz Lisp. No, Franz. Franz, as in Franz Liszt, the composer. It had lots of jokes about the 19th century composer.
Have you heard of Franz Liszt, Bryce?
No, it's got to be a pretty obscure language for Connor to not know about it.
I mean, I made a whole video at one point when I was working through the structure and interpretation of computer programs that was like the history of Lisps, and I discovered a ton of Lisps that I had never heard of, like Pico Lisp, and I don't know. There's a bunch I have heard of. There's one also called Dylan, I think, that was out of Microsoft.
That sounds later. That sounds a lot later. But
that was the 90s. But anyways, the whole point is, like, you know, there's a whole world of Lisps out there. People think of, like, there's the Lisp. there's Scheme and Racket, and then there's Clojure. But like behind the scenes, there's like 50 other Lisps that all vary in their language features and whatnot.
The thing about Lisp, you were saying it's homoiconic, which means data is program and program is data. And I got interested there. Well, I was interested a long time ago, but there was about quines. Do you guys know what a quine is?
Yeah.
A quine is...
I've heard it before, but I don't remember.
A quine is a program that, when run, produces its own source code. And it doesn't just do, like, you know, read the file and spit out the answer. But I remember writing a quine for Lisp, and it was like 6 lines long. And
that checks out.
That's, yeah. And but if you try to do it for C++, it's probably, I think, 50 lines or something. I know there was a great talk. I think there was a Lightning talk there recently. Well, maybe the last 3 years, about quines and how to write a quine. And it was, I can't remember, I think the person who gave it was French. I suspect they were, but I could be wrong
about
that.
I'll do some searching. Yeah. And there's definitely a bunch of talks out there. There's a famous set of quines, which I'm not going to remember the name of, but it's like they generate, it's a huge loop, like, and it's named after a dragon or snake that's eating its own tail.
Yeah.
Where like it started off with like a few languages, but now it's up to like, I don't know if it's 100 plus, but so it's like, you know, the Java generates the C++, generates the Ruby, and it goes through 100 different languages all the way back. And so, you know,
is there one of these that's simple enough that we could like talk through it right now on the podcast? Just because like I'm trying to mentally imagine like how one of these works.
The main problem is that you've got to handle quotation marks and emitting quotation marks, because basically what your quine is going to be, it's going to be like int main bracket bracket, and then you're going to have like printf or stud c out or whatever, and a big long string. And the problem with that is that you've got to handle the extra double quotes, and they get swallowed, so you have to produce them, and that's where all the tricks come in. And you have
you
to
understand
use a certain
the essence
amount
of what a quine is, though, right, Bryce?
I understand the essence. I would still like to see a simple one.
As I said, there is. A guy did a Lightning talk, and he showed how to write a quine in about 7 minutes. It was in one of the C++ conferences over the last few years.
All right, folks, we're taking a little mini detour. I will not share the screen, but I have up, because we don't do that on ADSP the podcast anymore. Bryce sometimes does, because he doesn't care about you, dear listener.
That's true.
I, however, do, and I am at rosettacode.org/wiki/quine, and I am not going to be able to count how many languages, but we're looking at roughly, I'd estimate 200 or 300. So I'm going to scroll, and I'm just going to give you the guesses. So 80 assembly looks to be a couple hundred. ABAP looks to be 30 lines, although there's a bunch of extra stuff. ACL2 is 6 lines, and they actually have a shorter one that is a single line. I don't know if ACL2
is
the language.
Is that a Lisp?
Never heard of this.
If I click on ACL2, it says ACL2 is a logic and programming language in which you can model computer systems together with a tool to help you prove properties of those models. ACL2 denotes a computational logic for applicative common Lisp.
Ah, Common Lisp. You see, it's a Lisp language. Yeah. Okay.
ACL.
I'm jumping down to the Bash one. This is how my mind works.
Oh, look at that. APL. Single line as well. Unsurprisingly.
Connor actually, is so pleased.
Now I'm gonna read this out for the listener. It's gonna sound like C++. It's one rotate, Ravel. It's Ravel commute. 9 reshape, and then single quote, single quote, single quote, and then inside the inner quotes, one rotate, ravel, commute, nine reshape. Interesting. So what is that doing basically? It's basically kind of performing a no-op, I think, or a small operation on what is essentially just going to be the exact same thing. And the nine reshape is going to give you this code twice because you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 characters inside your string. And when you reshape on a string, so similar to actually what we were talking about in Ruby earlier, in that case, we were trying to take more than we had where we gave, and it gave you back just what was there. In APL, when you do that with a reshape, which is basically trying to reshape the shape of your string, if you specify more, it actually cycles. So in this, it'll cycle, you know, if you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 and you try and do a take 10, you'll end up with 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, which you can argue which behavior is better. Is it the APL behavior? Is it the Ruby behavior? The point is that's how APL works. And I'm not sure if that made sense to the listener. Bryce, have you made sense of the bash code?
Yeah, I've looked at the C++ and the bash ones, and the bash ones are not very helpful because they just cheat and do awful things. But I
hey, there's no such thing as cheating when writing a quine. The whole point of a quine is that you just generate the source code that you initially wrote. That's the only rule. Like, there's no such thing as cheating.
Didn't we say just a few minutes ago that you can't read in the source file?
Correct. That's cheating.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
And I'm fairly certain that with the first one of the bash examples here, is essentially I don't think it actually reads in the source file, but it maps in. No, that's what it does pretty much. It maps in the file where the script is, and then it just prints that out.
Ooh, and I just realized when I said Ravel in APL, that was actually the monadic. It was the dyadic definition, so it would have been catenate.
I want to see the make one.
This is probably part one of a 4-part episode series. Be sure to check the show notes either in your podcast app or at adspthepodcast.com for links to anything we mentioned in today's episode, as well as a link to the GitHub discussion where you can leave comments, thoughts, and questions. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed and have a great day.
Low quality, high quantity. That is the tagline of our podcast.
It's not the tagline. Our tagline is chaos with sprinkles of information.